Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's National Novel Writing Month, or NaNoWriMo, that time of the year when all over the world, hundreds of thousands of people commit to writing a novel in a month. So how's yours coming? Well, if 50,000 words seems daunting, maybe you'd rather try writing a short story instead. Except that short stories can actually be even more difficult to write, for most writers anyway. That's because in a short story, there are no words to waste. Every single one counts. Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, what makes a short story great? Actor Jesse Eisenberg and former This American Life producer Diane Cook both have new collections out. We'll talk with them. But first, Ben Marcus. His most recent collection is called Leaving the Sea, and he also just edited an anthology called New American Stories. When Steve Paulson talked with him, he asked him to begin with a bit from the introduction.
Language is a drug, but a short story cannot be smoked. You can't inject it. Stories don't come bottled as a cream. You cannot have a story massaged into you by a bearish old man. You have to stare down a story until it wobbles, yields, then catapults into your face. But as squirrely as they are to capture, stories are the ideal deranger. If they are well made and you submit to them, they go in clean. Stories deliver their chemical disruption without the ashy hangover, the blacking out, the poison. They trigger pleasure, fear, fascination, love, confusion, desire, repulsion. Drugs get flushed from our systems, but not the best stories. Once they take hold, you couldn't scrape them out with a knife. While working on this book, I started to think of it as a medicine chest, filled with beguiling, volatile material, designed by the most gifted technicians. The potent story writers, to me, are the ones who deploy language as a kind of contraband, pumping it into us until we collapse on the floor, writhing, overwhelmed with feeling. Imagine trying to assert the importance of water, food, love, the company of others, shelter. There are some things that we need so innately that it feels awkward and difficult to explain why. To this list of crucial things without which we might perish, I would add stories. A short story works to remind us that if we are not sometimes baffled and amazed and undone by the world around us, rendered speechless and stunned, perhaps we are not paying close enough attention.
Wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I love that image of language as a drug. Where did that idea come from?
I don't really know. I think I was trying to wrestle with this question of what it feels like to read. And I think back to being a kid, staying inside on a nice day on the weekend and getting completely consumed by a book, absorbed by it, engrossed, just taken over, and putting the book down and realizing the world was changed for me. My parents looked different. My friends looked different. My house looked different. In other words, I was kind of intoxicated. My brain had been shifted around. And so I think when I started to think of it that way and started to pay attention to what the most beautiful, intense, compelling, gripping, entertaining stories did to me, it wasn't such a stretch to think, you know, it's like taking a drug. You're different after. You're altered.
So we've been talking about the power of language in great literature. What about specifically short stories? I mean, at one point you describe them as strategies in language to attack our tendency to feel too little.
Yeah, well, The short story seems to have a lot of pressure on it, a kind of gun at its back. There's a suspicion around stories. They are open to a kind of light ridicule up against the novel. And the story seems to kind of possess or seems to want to possess a kind of urgency so that within a sentence, within two sentences, whatever you were doing, you know, cleaning your house or watching TV, the story has to kind of compete against all that and grab you and not let you go. And it seems we're a lot more patient with novels. We sort of understand we might need to wade through 20 pages of description about how some characters met and where they went to school and the kinds of storytelling armature, background, exposition that can define great and beautiful novels. And I think I'm attracted to stories because they really don't have a sentence to spare. It seems that we're looking for reasons not to read them. And that's a really interesting challenge that I think story writers are meeting really, really beautifully.
So what were you looking for when you put together this? And well, you don't like the word anthology, but I don't know what else you'd call it.
Do I not?
The selection of short stories.
I was looking for just that, the experience of not wanting to stop reading. I was so lucky to be able to put this book together because I could gather hundreds of short story collections, literary magazines, individual printouts of stories that I'd heard about or that people had recommended to me. I could just make huge piles around myself and read and read and read and read. And in some ways, it was nice to not really know what I was looking for other than a kind of unforgettable experience. So if, for instance, I read something and picked it up a few days later and couldn't remember it at all, that was sometimes a sign that it had failed to endure in me. Now, I don't mean that to be a definitive criticism of that story, but I think I was just looking for stories that had a kind of long half-life that kept with me, that I couldn't forget.
Well, let's take one example of this. The very first story in your collection called Paranoia, and I don't even know how you say the author's name. Can you say it for me?
Yeah. It's Saeed Seyraf Yezidah, a terrific writer who was completely new to me when I started this project. And it was always exciting to find a writer I'd never even heard of. And there were six or seven of his stories I felt could have gone in this book. And this Paranoia was the one I settled on.
So what was it about this story that appealed to you?
The story is simple and plain and very inviting and easy to get into, and it reveals its riches subtly and slowly, and it kind of builds a lot of enigma and strangeness. There's a war going on, and we think we might know which war it is, but as we move through the story, we find we know less and less. And I think that Saeed, one of the many exciting things he does as a writer is, I guess the old-fashioned term for this would be defamiliarization, where he takes things that look familiar to us and kind of common, and he almost sort of applies a kind of wobble to them so that the world we think we know starts to quiver a little bit. But that helps us see and feel things behind the familiar that have gotten hidden because we think we know what there is to know about them.
Hmm. Well, could you give us a taste of this? Maybe read the first couple of paragraphs?
Sure. This is a story called Paranoia by Saeed Seyraf Yezidah. When April arrived, it started to get warm and everyone said that the war was definitely going to happen soon and there was nothing anybody could do to stop it. The diplomats were flying home, the flags were coming out, and the call-ups were about to begin. Walking across the bridge, I would sometimes see freight trains lumbering by, loaded top to bottom with tanks or jeeps, once even the wings of airplanes heading out west or down south. Some line had been crossed, something said or done, something irrevocable on our side or on the enemy's, from which there was no longer any possibility of turning back. I hadn't been following matters that closely, so I'd missed exactly when things had taken a turn. Nevertheless, everyone was saying that the war was going to happen soon, and so I said it, too. Then May came, and it got hot, and Roberto broke his nose and asked me if I would come visit him in the hospital. Blood everywhere, he told me over the phone. Apparently, he'd been lifting weights at the gym when one of his buddies, in order to emphasize some conversational point he was making, fainted like a boxer and swung at Roberto's face. The buddy had meant merely to pantomime the punch, but with his arms heavy light from having just bench-pressed 300 pounds, he'd lost the ability to gauge distance, strength, or speed, and he cracked Roberto right in the nose. I wanted to question the details of the story because Roberto was subject to hyperbole, and also because I was selfish and didn't want to make the trip across town. But I was the closest thing to family that Roberto had, and on the telephone he did sound like he had a sock stuffed down his throat and up his nose.
Yeah, that's such a great setup. I mean, so suggestive about things to come. I mean, for one thing, the sense of a lot of power, of might, of violence that can't even quite be controlled.
There's something really ominous, and one of the things I like so much is that you get the sense that the narrator doesn't even really know what's happening. He says that, you know, war was apparently coming. He wasn't really following it. Other people were saying war was coming, so he said it too. And these things are, they're kind of, there's this instability to that that as a reader, I think I really am attracted to. You know, it's just not clear what's factual. And yet you could also just believe it. So there's all this room inside these seemingly innocent statements. But then, of course, it just gets specific. It's, you know, first there's, you know, a war is coming, but then, his friend gets a bloody nose. So we're moving all over the place there. And I think it becomes quickly clear that we really don't know where this is or when this is or what the rules are exactly. And yet, I think with a writer this good, or for me anyway, I just trust him. I feel, well, I'm going to read whatever he writes. I'm just going to follow this because someone's in charge, even if he's not really revealing the details.
Ben Marcus is a novelist, short story writer, and the editor of the anthology New American Stories. He talked with Steve Paulson. And by the way, another one of the stories that Marcus chose for that anthology is by Robert Coover. Coover is now in his 80s, but he's still pushing the envelope with his metafictions. Ben and Steve talked about Coover's short story, Going for a Beer.
It's a story about a guy going for a beer, except Coover, the great literary trickster who's been around for quite a long time and who I must say was my teacher when I was a student and was just a phenomenal teacher, plays a lot of tricks with time and is sort of covering the entire lifetime of a character so that things are happening enormously quickly and also out of order. He's very well known for a story called The Babysitter, which is a kind of cult iconic story in which a similar sort of thing happens. Family goes out, leaves their kids with a babysitter, and all hell breaks loose, but really all hell, like, you know, the laws of physics collapse.
Well, in this story, you know, in the same sentence, you know, you're having a beer and, you know, by the end of the sentence, you've had a child by the woman you've met in the bar.
That's right.
The child she bears him, his or another's, reminds him, as if he needed reminding, that time is fast moving on. He has responsibilities now, and he decides to check whether he still has the job he had when he first met her. He does. His absence, if he has been absent, is not remarked on, but he is not congratulated on his marriage either. No doubt because, he comes back to him now, before he met his wife, he was engaged to one of his colleagues, and their co-workers had already thrown them an engagement party, so they must resent the money they spent on gifts.
It's important to say that he's having a lot of fun with this story, but he's also telling the life story of a man, and, you know, it more or less ends with this character on his deathbed. Sorry if that's a spoiler for others, but it's such a short story that you'd figure it out soon enough. So he finds a way to narrate an entire life, which is an enormously difficult thing to do. And it feels funny and it feels strange. You sense that the kind of pin has been pulled out on the logic and the story, and yet things are making a kind of crazy sense. I don't think you could change a word in that story without causing serious damage. So I see that piece as a great performance, but also as a stirring story that Coover's sort of known for being more of an experimental prankster who's kind of using the methods of fiction to turn stories inside out, to remind us of the devices that drive narratives, and in some sense to be in revolt from more sentimental kind of feeling-driven fiction. And I think one of the things that so excited me about Going for a Beer is I feel that he does both. It's not sentimental, but it's a deeply emotional story that has all the formal innovation that he's known for.
Ben Marcus on Going for a Beer by Robert Coover. The story is featured in New American Stories, edited by Marcus. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, actor Jesse Eisenberg talks about his other gig as a short story writer, and we'll find out how the animal kingdom serves as muse for public radio producer Diane Cook. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You've probably seen Jesse Eisenberg, the actor, in films like The Social Network, The Squid and the Whale, and The End of the Tour. But have you read Jesse Eisenberg, the writer? He's the author of three plays and now a debut collection of short stories called Bream Gives Me Hiccups. The British newspaper The Guardian has already named it one of the essential books of the year. Jesse Eisenberg was in Madison recently and stopped by our studio.
So this is a story that is one chapter in a series of stories about a young boy who is saddled with his mother after the divorce of his parents. And I say saddled only because his mother does not want him to travel around with her. In this particular chapter, they go to Thanksgiving with the neighbors who are vegan. And this is called Thanksgiving with Vegans. And this is from the perspective of a 9-year-old boy. So, yes, excuse my naivete. Thanksgiving with vegans. Last night, Mom and I went to Thanksgiving dinner at a vegan family's house, which is kind of like going to temple for Christmas. Mom said that vegans are people who don't eat any meat or cheese or shave. And since Mom doesn't like to cook, she decided that we needed to go to our neighbor's house for Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving used to be my favorite holiday because Mom and Dad and I would drive up to Dad's parents' house, and Dad and I would roll down the humongous hill in Grandpa's backyard while Grandma cooked with Mom. But when Dad left Mom to be in love with another woman, Mom told me that I was never allowed to speak to Dad's parents again, which I thought was unfair because they were my grandparents and we have a separate relationship. I also used to love Thanksgiving because of the food. Grandma would make a huge turkey with gravy and stuffing, and everyone would make a big deal about Grandpa carving the turkey like he had a special skill that the rest of us could never learn. But our neighbors, the vegans, don't eat turkey or real gravy, and they don't put marshmallows on top of their sweet potatoes because they said marshmallows come from horse feet, which I didn't know and I hope is a lie. Not only do they not eat turkey, but the vegans placed framed pictures of two turkeys on their table with the turkeys' names underneath, which were Mabel and Todd. It was strange to see pictures of turkeys because no one ever really takes pictures of turkeys, and it was even stranger to see that they had names because no one really names turkeys, especially with a name like Todd, which sounds like the name of a boy who asks a teacher for more homework. All of the foods were labeled with little turkey-shaped signs, and I remembered the names carefully so that I know to avoid them in future Thanksgivings. The main foods were lentil and mushroom loaf with savory potato filling, and stuffed maple tofu, and the side foods were gluten-free spinach roasted fingerlings and king oyster whipped sweet potatoes with herbs and without marshmallows. Reading the weird names of the foods, I suddenly missed Dad, and I thought that maybe Mom did too, even though she always says that she hates him. I think that even if you hate someone, it's easy to miss them on the holidays.
That's such a funny story, and it's so sad all at once, and you make that instantaneous switch from hilarious to poignant.
Yeah.
So quickly. How do you do that?
Because it's true. My family has vegan Thanksgiving. We take it a step further, but it would seem too absurd for a book that's an already collection of absurd stories because my family calls it Thanksgiving. They actually have the pictures of the turkeys and they...
You're kidding. Wait, your family really has the pictures of the turkeys on the table?
Yes, Mabel and not Todd, but I thought Todd would be a funnier name. It was Mabel and some other turkey. It says... Oh, this is Mabel. She's 6 months old and she loves dancing and jazz music. That's really what it says. And then my sister spends about 45 minutes before we eat vegan food reading about what it's like to be a caged turkey, about to get your feathers boiled off and your beak cut. And then we eat tofu.
You're kidding. That scene is in that story, too. And that's the one where I thought, no, he just went a little overboard. That's like, seriously, nobody would do that.
It's true. We've done it every year. Yes. No, my family is, they're all vegetarians or vegans. And yes, various forms of not eating meat.
And big turkey supporters, evidently.
Yes, especially on that holiday. And I feel similarly. I mean, I don't eat turkey. And I feel similarly, especially on Thanksgiving. People think of it as this kind of, yes, joyous holiday. But my family has a way of taking anything that normally feels joyous and making it miserable.
So what made you, if this is your normal way of celebrating Thanksgiving, what made you want to write a story in which a 9-year-old boy basically looks at your family Thanksgiving and doesn't like it?
Because he's also correct. Like, what's great about writing from the perspective of a 9-year-old boy is that he could see the hypocrisy in the adult world. And he's not old enough to understand why those kind of social norms were created. So he understands the hypocrisy, but he's not old enough to realize why adults have certain kind of behaviors to get through the day. A lot of what we do as adults is hypocritical, but we do it to kind of get through the day. He's able to see that hypocrisy, but without understanding why. So it's an interesting character to write from and an interesting perspective to have. So there's something kind of silly about having a vegan Thanksgiving, which he comments on. But also there's something that's very nice about it and very thoughtful and, you know, environmentally and humanely for the animals.
So this is part of a story cycle. There are, what, 12? Different restaurant reviews that this 9-year-old kid, I can't remember, do we ever learn his name?
No.
Yeah, okay, so this nameless 9-year-old boy is doing these restaurant reviews, except they're, what, 2,000 points? I've forgotten, how many does he give the vegan Thanksgiving?
The vegan is probably maybe 546 out of 2,000 stars. Because, yes, he has a very specific grading system in the way a 9-year-old boy would have, where you could allot a very specific number of stars out of 2,000. And for him, it has absolute meaning. He'd probably be able to define exactly why it has 546 as opposed to 547.
And his parents have divorced and he's living with his mother. And he has such sympathy for his mother. And at the same time, his mother is clearly not a great mother. She's the first to say.
Yes, exactly. She's not only uninterested in having him accompany her, but she actually only takes him around because as part of the divorce settlement, the father has agreed to pay for anything she does with the boy because he's the joint property. So she is kind of taking him around reluctantly. But over the course of the stories, you realize her goodness, which she has spent years resisting. She's a broken and lonely person, and this little boy is able to see through the hypocrisies to realize that she's not a terrible person, that she's a good woman who's just lonely and looking for love. And he's able to see that because he's able to see kind of the moments in between the moments that adults, you know, like to feature.
Was it hard to come up with this character? I think I don't see how you can write in that voice without having that 9-year-old boy be you, really.
Yes, it is. I feel a bit kind of alienated from like normal adult life. And I enjoy infantilizing myself in order to get help from strangers. And so I think like that. I also have a bit of a stunted life experience because right in high school, I started acting in movies, and you are necessarily treated like a child, not only whilst acting in a movie, but in the public. No one really asks you to do anything that they ask other adults to do. So,
wait, what do you mean?
I really don't have to do anything. No one requires me to know about taxes or how to parallel park. I mean, I know how to do those things, but people offer to do them for me because I'm, you know, in the public eye. So,
Are you a normal human being? Do you go to supermarkets and buy milk and English muffins and stuff?
I do, but, well, we're vegan. So we buy soy milk and gluten-free English muffins.
Well, do you go to the supermarket and buy those things?
Yes. I live a normal life, but I see that if people notice me, they treat me in a I would say there's a bit of an infantilization that occurs with recognizing somebody. Mm. There's like a kind of, I would say, an unconscious sympathy they have for me because they're excited, but they also, it's like a nervousness. I'm talking about myself like I'm the Pope. I'm not so special or unusual, but people
but you're,
do.
You're a big actor, you're a star, you're a celebrity, and so people do that.
Yes, I would say there's kind of, when people notice me, there is something a bit that they infantilize me a little bit. So,
but do you like that?
Yeah, I don't mind it because you can get away with things, you know. Oh, can I go on this roof? I don't know how this works, and I get to go on a roof. So like that. Can you do this quick taxes for me? Oh, sure, we'll do those taxes for you. So yes, it's fine. So I can understand how like the 9-year-old thinks. I also I started writing this while I was acting in a movie called The Double, and my character was like this kind of. I was playing two characters. I was playing this kind of. Again, this kind of emotionally stunted, sweet young man. And then I was playing his doppelganger, who was this kind of brash, arrogant id version of him. And so I was mostly in the mindset of this sweet, stunted man. And so that's when I started writing these. So a lot of times my acting kind of experiences will end up dovetailing into what I'm writing.
I was going to ask what you think you've taken from acting that informs your stories or helps you write, because they're fairly different. In some ways, they're very different occupations.
I like to think of them as more linked because I'm doing a Woody Allen movie now. I'm asked both to kind of improvise within his style because of the nature of how he shoots movies. He doesn't like to do a lot of editing, so the actors are supposed to fill up the scene, not just read the lines from the script. So my kind of, let's say, writer mind is often turned on. And I'm also asked to kind of use an emotional creativity, which is a bit esoteric and maybe pretentious to describe, but I'm asked to kind of mine my own emotions to use for fictional purposes.
What were you like as a 9-year-old boy?
I was, sad and introverted. Yeah, I was like a kind of a sad child. I don't know why. I guess because the antidepressants hadn't really come to my town at that point.
You also that acute an observer?
No, I wasn't such a great observer because I was mostly just worried. So I probably didn't have the kind of insight and acumen that this boy has. That said, I know children who have this acumen. They're endlessly interesting to me because they have at once a maturity and a kind of a mind that has really profound ideas, but at the same time, such limited life experience. And to me, that's even more interesting than the kind of wizened elderly person that has, you know, the life experience. Because there's just a openness to unusual things.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse Eisenberg is an actor, a playwright, and the author of Bream Gives Me Hiccups and other stories. This American Life producer, Diane Cook, spent years putting real stories about real people on the radio. But on the side, she was writing surreal short stories. Her debut collection is called Man vs. Nature. It's a finalist for the Believer Magazine's Book Award and the LA Times Book Prizes. Doug Gordon sat down to talk with her.
Diane, I've heard that one of the ways you come up with the premises for your short stories is you imagine things that happen in the animal world and transpose those into our world. The human world. Can you tell me about that?
I like to think about humans on a kind of a scale of wildness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's an instinctual element to us that's, you know, very alive, but we call it different things. We kind of toggle between kind of an instinctual reaction to things and a rational thinking reaction to things.
Yeah.
And I really like the play in between those. And, you know, we call it like anger or passion or fury or fear when we act on an instinctual level. But I think of it as like a wilder part of ourselves that isn't gone and lost from long ago. It's still in us. We just mediate it differently now. And we, you know, apply it in different ways based on our civilized life. So when I watch animals or I think about animals in the wild, I'm looking at them to kind of inform how I act in the world or how I respond to things. one of the stories in the book plays a lot on maternal fear. And it's just from watching like animal documentaries where animals are like constantly having their young stolen from them.
Yeah.
Or their young don't make it, and so they have lots of babies.
The opening story is called Moving On, and it's very poignant and very powerful. Can you tell me a bit about this story?
Yeah, Moving On, again, was just a kind of thought experiment of what happens if we didn't have a choice, or we had one choice in life. We got to make one set of choices in life, and then after that, if it didn't work out, we were kind of at the mercy of a system that was put in place to kind of like take care of us because we hadn't succeeded in some way at regular life. So the story is about people who have been married but then for whatever reason lose their spouse. They've either lost their spouse to death or sometimes occasionally just things don't work out. And once you've lost your spouse, you get put into a shelter basically where you are prepped and kind of placed and kept out of society until you're over your grief and you can successfully manage a new relationship. And that new relationship is chosen for you by the people who work at the shelter. And these shelters are everywhere, and it happens for men, women, and children. But my story follows one woman whose husband died young before they'd had any kind of real kind of foothold in the world. No children, you know, just kind of starting out. And she's put in the shelter, and the story is really about her process of kind of an incredible, bewildering grief. Like, I had this beautiful thing. We loved each other so much, but it's gone. So now what? Like, my life feels a little out of my hands.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Moving On.
Yeah, so in this section that happens pretty early on, our narrator has just arrived to the shelter, and the story's told in kind of almost diaristic dispatches, and she is going over what kind of day-to-day life is at the shelter and kind of what the different materials are that they're given and the different things that are expected of them in the shelter where she's been moved to in order to help her move on from her grief. I'm supposed to pretend our wedding day was lonely, and that rather than feeling love and happiness, I felt doubt, dread. It's all very hard. But they say it's helpful in getting placed. What I find funny is that since my husband died, as he was dying, really, I hadn't considered that this might be hard. I thought it was just the next step. My case manager says that this is normal, and that the feeling of detachment comes from shock. She says that if I can hold on to it and skip over the bewildering grief that follows, I'll be better off. The grief-stricken spend more time here, years in some cases. Practice, 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 she always says. We're each given a framed picture of a man, some model, and I take it back to my cell and put it by my bed as instructed. I'm supposed to replace my husband's face in my memory with this man's face, while being careful not to get too attached. The man in the photo won't be my new husband. The man is too smooth. His teeth are very straight and white, and there is a glistening in his hair from gel that is hardened. I can tell he probably uses a brand of soap I would hate the smell of. He looks as though he doesn't need to shave every day. My husband had a beard. But, I remind myself, that doesn't matter now. What I prefer is no longer of concern.
That was great. Thank you.
Thanks.
This story is very heartbreaking, and at the same time, there's this kind of Orwellian brainwashing going on. The state is trying to fast-track the act of grieving in a very clinical and very bureaucratic way.
Yes. Sometimes that's what it feels like to me, or I feel this, I don't know, that there's a pressure for us to kind of, like, put our best foot forward when it comes to loss and just, I don't know, kind of smile through it in this way that just feels false to me and always did. I wrote the story a few years after my mother died, and so probably enough time to kind of just process it or begin to at any rate. And I remember all these stories I would hear. It always seemed like grieving with grace was really valued. Whereas I was grieving like just like a brat. You know, I was so mad and I had so many feelings that like nobody else maybe in my family seemed to share. They all kind of handled it much better than I did.
You grieved longer?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I still grieve in this way. Whereas my dad, say, you know, her husband, you know, really made it, you know, like kind of a goal to like, well, I'm still alive. Let me have a life still, which is admirable and probably was very hard, but was also kind of an amazing thing to watch and kind of parse and get my head around as I was kind of in the throes of a really, I don't know, I don't want to say like, it wasn't a negative grief, but it was just so, it was so intense and it felt like it was never going to lift.
And has writing the story helped it lift at all? Was it cathartic in some way to write the story?
Yeah, it was. You know, I mean, I think it had lifted at that point too, but it was more the story was helping me kind of think about the decision to move on doesn't have to be, it can be a decision that you're not even ready for, but you can still make the decision. Does that make sense?
Yeah, oh, it makes a lot of sense. And I can really relate because my mother passed away in June of 2014. And you mentioned about your dad saying, well, I'm still alive. And that's the thing that I find difficult for being still mm-hmm. alive and having known my mom, you know, as you knew your mom your whole life. And then all of a sudden she was there your whole life and then she's gone. And then your life afterwards seems it's really hard to deal with. And it's really kind of very nightmarish and very sad. It has been for me anyway and continues to be.
Yeah.
You spent 6 years as a producer for Ira Glass's very popular public radio show, This American Life. I'm curious, how did working on This American Life shape your approach to writing fiction?
It shaped my fiction writing by, it basically taught me how to tell a story, which I think is a hard thing to learn. I think very few people do it naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But it taught me how to tell a story. So writing sometimes more often is an exercise in just excavating emotion. Which also, like, was kind of a part of my job at This American Life.
Man versus Nature, your collection, was shortlisted for the Believer magazine's Book Award, and the Believer described your book as a funny, scary, sensitive examination of the brittleness of human existence. And that, I think, really captures it. Is that what you were going for?
I mean, I hope so. In my dreams, yeah. It was dreamy to hear people respond to the book in a way that both got the darkness and understood kind of the beauty behind the darkness that exists in the book. Because I never look at life thinking it has to be all sunny. I think the best things I learn from life come from kind of the weirder, more hard to categorize moments.
That's Diane Cook. She's the author of Man versus Nature, and she talked with Doug Gordon. That's it for our conversation about short stories. But coming up, Margaret Atwood's latest visionary dystopian novel is on our minds. How will she destroy our civilization this time? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. Imagine the economy has crashed. You've lost your job, and you're living in your car trying to fend off gangs of roving thugs. And then you see an ad for a full-time job that comes with a comfortable suburban home. There's just one catch. You get to live half-time in the house, but the rest of the time you have to live in prison. Welcome to Margaret Atwood's latest speculative fiction.
Ed opens his arms like a TV preacher. His voice gets louder. If prisons were scaled out and handled rationally, they could be win-win viable economic units. So many jobs could be spawned by them. Construction jobs, maintenance jobs, cleaning jobs, guard jobs, hospital jobs, an ever-flowing cornucopia of jobs. Medium-sized towns with large penitentiaries could maintain themselves, and the people inside such towns could live in middle-class comfort. And if every citizen were either a guard or a prisoner, the result would be full employment. And since it was unrealistic to expect certified criminality from 50% of the population, the fair thing would be for everyone to take turns. 1 month in, 1 month out. Think of the savings, with every dwelling serving two sets of residents. It was timeshare taken to its logical conclusion. It all makes sense.
Margaret Atwood's new novel, The Heart Goes Last, blends dystopia with social satire. Her two main characters, Stan and Charmaine, are a young married couple. They're barely scraping by, and when they hear about the Positron Project, they jump at the chance to live in that nice, cozy house in the town of Consilience, even if it means they also have to spend time in prison. Of course, since this is a Margaret Atwood novel, that's the point at which things get pretty weird. Steve Paulson asked how she got the idea for this one.
The genesis of it, the premise of it, is that there has been a 2008-style economic collapse in Stan's and Charmaine's part of the country. That would probably be the Detroit-like part. A lot of people lost their houses in that financial meltdown, and a lot of businesses closed. So Stan and Charmaine have had jobs. They've had a house, they've had a mortgage, but they have lost those things in the meltdown, and they're now living in their car, which is unpleasant and also dangerous because the area is full of vandals and people on the loose who would like to get hold of their car. So when they see the Positron Project being advertised with a digital tour of the house they would get, it's just so appealing. You get white fluffy towels, you get sheets with flowers on them, you get a bed. It's not actually very comfortable sleeping in your car. All of this is just very appealing, and they apply and they get in.
So the story is set, I presume, somewhere in the near future.
Yeah.
And as you say, society is crumbling, basically. And so then this prison with a smile seems to offer refuge.
It does offer refuge. Think of the alternatives. But there are some questions to be asked about it. And Stan is the more skeptical of the two, and he starts asking them to himself pretty soon. He wants, for instance, to know if it's a private for-profit prison scheme, how is the profit being made? And Stan would also like to know what happened to the actual criminals who were in there before it became the Positron prison scheme.
Why were you drawn to this coming together of prison life and community life?
Well, I guess because I started thinking about it a long time ago when I was a Victorian literature student. It was a big theme for a number of writers in that era, notably Charles Dickens, who was pretty obsessed by prisons because his dad was in one when he was a child. So I started then, and the history of prison reform in that age, but also the history of for-profit penal colonies, of which North Carolina was one. So Australia is particularly instructive because at first they shipped only men to that colony, but then they realized the men were quite rowdy and they decided to send some women to get married to them and settle them down. But they didn't have a lot of women housebreakers. In fact, they didn't have any women housebreakers, so they lowered the bar on what you had to do to get transported if you were a woman. They criminalized more things because they needed to fill a quota. And any time you've got a system like that that has a quota, you're going to see that effect.
So it would seem that on the surface that your novel is kind of this crazy dystopian story of a society gone amok. But you're suggesting maybe it's not so far off from the real world?
I don't put things in those kinds of books that I write that are far off from the real world.
You want to have something that's just, you look at things.
Just around the corner. Just a couple of different decisions and we'd be there.
Hmm. It turns out that your town of Consilience has a lot of rules. No rock music allowed. You can't interact with family outside of Consilience. There's heavy...
You're in. Yep.
You're heavy surveillance. All the communication with the town is monitored. Is this strictly an imaginary landscape for you? Or do you...
No. No, it's kind of where we live. As we have learned, there are a lot of people listening in on us.
So the surveillance in particular, that's what you see as especially the real world analogy here.
Oh, there's more than one real world analogy, but that's one of them. The other one is in the field of personal robotics, which are making great strides. You can catch up on Pepper, the robot that can read the expressions on your face, and you can catch up on the Japanese who have now made a simulated person whose skin can get goosebumps. And the man in California who is making really quite interesting talking sex bots.
Well, and sex bots figure prominently in your story. I mean, these lifelike androids, you call them prostabots, essentially sex robots.
I didn't make that up, actually. If you put prostabots in on your web searcher, that's what you'll get.
So one of the questions you seem to be asking in the story is that if we're offered enough pleasure, and if we're provided the basic comforts of life, would we be willing to give up the freedom we have in the outside world? Essentially, could we be happy if we're willing to check our free will at the door?
Or some of it. You know, history has shown that when people feel really frightened, they will choose options that provide safety, or that they think provide safety, and they will give up some of their freedoms in return, and it's happened time and time again.
If you had to classify this novel, what would you call it?
No, let's not go there.
No, I mean dystopian fiction, is that what it is?
Yeah, partly. Mm-hmm.
You don't like having your fiction called science fiction, do you?
Well, if it were, then I wouldn't mind it at all. And I've written some shorter pieces that are definitely science fiction. But when people use that term, they pretty much think of, you know, spaceships, aliens, those sorts of things.
You prefer speculative fiction to describe your own work?
I think it's more accurate. This whole genre had two granddaddies, and one of them was Jules Verne, who wrote about submarines and things like that. He was writing about things that he thought were happening or would happen or could happen. And the other one was H.G. Wells, and he wrote War of the Worlds and The Time Machine, which are two of the big seminal works of sci-fi. He wrote about things that, you know, just weren't going to happen. Martians being shot from Mars in tin cans, and they turned out to be super intelligent sort of tentacled heads that ate people or sucked the blood out of them. And Jules Verne, when he heard about that, he was horrified. He said, but he's making things up. So those are the two origins, and I think there are two families in that area. And the Jules Verne one led to people like Orwell, and the H.G. Wells thing led to things like Star Wars. So I'm in the Jules Verne family of that kind of fiction.
Why do you think we are seeing so many dystopian books and movies these days? I mean, they're everywhere.
Of all kinds, you know, fantasy and reality. I think it's partly because people feel unsettled about the future, especially young people, and they are envisaging a future in which there's a lot more social instability, and climate change is factoring into that in really a big way. In fact, there's a whole subgenre called cli-fi, which is climate fiction. So I think that's coming just from where people fear that they are, just as George Orwell's 1984 was written in 1948, and it was about Soviet-style socialism as it would get played out in England if it were to be played out. Stuff comes from where we are. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, I think he was traumatized by a visit to Hollywood in the 30s. Well, he was. Oh, no. There's going to be perfume fountains. What are we going to do?
Well, and various people have said that if you want to point to dystopian stories, Huxley's Brave New World is maybe more accurate than Orwell's Big Brother world. I mean, being killed by pleasure.
Yeah, but I think it's a combo. For instance, Orwell got the surveillance right, no question. Right after the Cold War ended and the wall came down, everybody thought it was going to be Huxley all the way. But I think we now realize that we're living in a blend, that each one of them got some of those things right.
Well, speaking of sort of imagining what the future might be like, you did something kind of crazy not that long ago. I mean, you wrote a novel for this project in Norway called The Future Library. It's been placed in a sealed box and won't be open for 100 years?
That's it. I'll describe this project to you, which was cooked up by a 34-year-old conceptual artist called Katie Patterson. And Katie's idea was and is, in a Norwegian forest near Oslo, 1,000 trees have been planted and they will grow for 100 years. And in each year of that 100 years, a different writer around the world, any language, will be asked to contribute a manuscript to the Future Library. Any form, doesn't have to be a novel, it could be one word. And the other rule is you can't tell what's in the box. You can reveal the title, but you can't reveal anything else about it. This project seized the imaginations of people all around the world because it's so hopeful. It assumes there will be people. They will be able to read. The library will still exist in 100 years. The forest will still exist. Think of all of that hopeful stuff in there.
Yeah. What's the title of your book?
The title of my book is Scribbler Moon.
It's kind of it's a fascinating imaginative exercise because I would think one thing you'd have to do is to think about what people would want to read 100 years from now.
Well, of course, you have no idea any more than you have any idea of what people would want to read now. All of that is gambling. But I think every time you're writing anything, you're addressing an unknown audience. But I was the kind of child who liked to bury things in jars in the backyard and was quite thrilled whenever I was digging around, doing gardening and whatever, to find something from an earlier age. I love those stories of people discovering caches and hoards and things that were buried and have lain unknown for up to, you know, thousands of years.
That's Margaret Atwood talking with Steve Paulson about her new novel, The Heart Goes Last. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tungekar, and Craig Ely. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for spending time with us today.
PRI, Public Radio International.